Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke. Don't do
if I had $1 million.
Well, welcome back to Sachs and Jackson. I'm Tom Rookie on the board. SP Futures down 375. NASDAQ Futures down 86. We've been starting down and ended up for a few days now, so I'm putting much stack in that. As we seem to be pouring money in this system, I checked the latest money supply numbers, and in the last 6 months, we were on a 7.1% annual rate, which is good for pumping up markets. It's good for pumping up prices of houses. It's really good at pumping up inflation, and I think nobody seems to care. So that's where that all is. But we have Professor Kevin.
Good morning.
How are you? Do you think when our guy Lou goes to Russia, he uses the name Lou Lewis?
No, I don't think so.
Maybe probably not.
It's already taken, and why would you use the name of a mediocre baseball player? Because Lou Lewis was not a very good he was a very mediocre baseball player. That Lou Gehrig guy, he turned out to be okay. But
yeah. For those that don't know, as we've been going back and forth, and we'll probably open it up a little bit again this morning on this college versus professional, because you see that our alma mater, our hero, our coach, has decided not to allow anybody to come back from signing a professional contract as well. So he's joining the ranks of the dirty SEC and Big Ten.
Actually, I think he made his announcements before they made theirs, but so joining the ranks, I think they're joining his ranks.
Well, his article came out a day later, so a big article about him. They made it sound, the one I read yesterday, that he was joining.
He was standing at a podium answering questions after football practice.
It's very possible that he was first, but
does it matter? No,
I think it does. Well, we're here just to give people an idea. As we are in a generation, as Lou accused Matt Weber one day of being a moral relativist, you get to decide on your own what definitions are. And there's an article here, actually it's from somebody in Quora Digest. Anyway, Kevin and I were bantering back and forth about Lou Lewis. Lou Lewis was a name used by Lou Gehrig as an alias to play for the Hartford Senators. 1921, minor leaguer named Lou Lewis stepped to the plate for the Hartford Senators. Fans had no idea they were watching future Yankee legend Lou Gehrig secretly playing illegally. At the time, Gehrig was preparing to enter the Columbia University on an athletic scholarship. However, the Gehrig family was in dire financial straits. His father struggled with health issues and unemployment, leaving his mother to support the family by working as a maid and a cook. Desperate to help his parents pay the bills, Gehrig caught the attention of Arthur Irwin, a scout and former manager who had connections to the Hartford Senators and minor league Eastern League, blah, blah, blah. Irwin offered the young powerhouse a brief contract to play professional baseball for a salary before his college classes began. Now, of course, in those days, collegiate rules, actually, a professional was somebody who got paid. Now we were running all over that definition. College rules strictly forbade student-athletes from playing professional sports. Anyone caught participating in a professional league could permanently lose their amateur status and their college eligibility. To circumvent this, Irwin suggested Gehrig play under an assumed name, leading to the creation of his alias. Anyway, he ended up getting caught and he served a year suspension where he couldn't play at Columbia. Now, that helped his family, I'm not sure. So now I would like, matter of fact, I'm a big fan of Coach Friedman, but if he was on the show, I certainly would say...
Freeman.
Freeman, whatever. I keep Milton Friedman.
You probably ought to get his name.
Milton Friedman. Friedman, what's the difference? Freeman. Anyway, I would ask him, what exactly do you think Hartman was? Do you think he wasn't the professional? And what goes on in people's minds, Kevin, where it's sort of like we want free speech, but if somebody says something we don't like, we got to shut them up. I mean,
Tom, what? I mean, that's fine. That would be a fine question for Marcus Freeman. But has he ever made any kind of insinuation that these guys are not professionals anymore?
Well, in what the article I read, it was we don't want professional players coming back into college.
Okay, he doesn't want NFL. If he had said we don't want NFL players coming back into college, would you have been better with it?
Well, it's the same definition, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but isn't that what he was really saying?
Okay, but my point is, you can't be half a gangster. I mean, what do you think these people are? I mean, you know, and it's funny. Everybody has their own way of, and I'm not accusing anybody. I'm just saying I do the same thing, Kevin. Sometimes I wonder why I do, but I do. When it's something you don't like, you sort of backpedal. I mean, Lou yesterday, being the terrific attorney that he is, starts talking about labor agreements. I'm talking about the Sherman Act. I mean, it says any combination to restrain a trade is illegal. Okay, 15 schools, if Notre Dame says they're not going to bring anybody to play for them that has played for the Bears, I have no problem with that. If 50 50 schools get together and say none of us will, I got a problem with it. It's a combination and restraint of trade. Because I actually read the law, you know. I mean, it's just me.
That one, you'd have to take that one up with the Big Ten and the SEC. But it really gets to be under what circumstances, doesn't it? And the Big Ten and the SEC do have people on the quarter system. So what Freeman said is he didn't say I would never take a player who was coming back from Texas A&M. He had one of his own former players, one of his own former players that was coming back from an NFL camp. And so that was really what prompted the question at the podium. Are you interested in getting him back? But he would have to come back as a grad student. And what Freeman said is, it's too late. We've started classes already. I'd have to get him through the admissions process and then placed in classes, and he wouldn't be able to, you know, he'd be too far behind to be successful. So, no, we can't do that. And I think that's going to be true of just about any school that starts its semester at the end of August. Now, there are a lot of schools on quarter systems, several out on the West Coast, I know, but schools also like Northwestern, I believe, is on quarters. Illinois might be, where, you know, they really don't start until end of September. And in that case, I don't see why you would bar a player who was eligible from applying and attending your school. That, you know, so that is when you're talking about cartels and acting in concert, that's where there's a problem. But I don't think any school on a semester system is going to have any problem saying I can't do this, unless maybe someone had an application in for grad school all along and had been accepted and had been you know, and placed in classes, and then NFL team, you can say, okay, I'm not coming.
For those that don't, I'm unaware of some of the detail what Kevin's talking about, because he's spot on, by the way, is I think the NFL, I don't know if it's their final cuts, but Sunday's the big cut day, right?
Yeah.
So there's going to be, you know, whatever, 300 people out of a job, whatever the number is, probably more than that. Notre Dame starts school.
They already have started school.
Okay, they already have. When we were there, it was after Labor Day. But I was going to say, this year, Labor Day is so late, they probably start before Labor Day.
They started Monday.
Even if they started next Monday or the Monday after, there's no way you get somebody into the place by then. But if you're on a quarter system, you can. But what about...
Yeah, you also, on that quarter system, you're ending much later, too, in the spring. And then the summer session runs when it does, which is later, and then they come back after their break. So,
well, of course, now I'm going to give you a what if. What if it's you and me, and we happen to be, you know, cleverer than the average bear, and we have a year of eligibility left at Notre Dame or someplace. And guess what? We applied to graduate school, and we're in. And by the way, neither one of us think we're going to make the Bears, but we try out anyway. Now what? Well, and then we get cut.
Yeah, so there you are. You know, that's exactly what I described a minute ago. I suppose you could apply to grad school. And it doesn't have, you know, in some cases, these guys haven't finished their undergrad degrees. So you still have to register and enroll in classes and all that kind of stuff. So that's all part of the process will get in the way. But let's just say he's got his degree, he's graduated, and he wants to apply to grad school. He could have applied to grad school last May.
Yeah.
And as a way of hedging his bet. And if he's in, he's in. And if he gets cut by the Bears, he can come and go to grad school. He'd be a week behind on classes, but that could be manageable. And then, if he does make it, he just says, you know, sorry, I'm withdrawing. And there you go. So yes, that process would work. And I won't be surprised if some people are smart enough to do it that way.
Well, I mean, if it was you and me, you might have a chance trying out for the Bears. I think we could probably go to the Bear coach last Sunday and say, hey, do I have any chance of making this thing? He's probably going to say no. I'm going to say, okay, see, I got class tomorrow morning. I mean, right, duh. It could happen. Why not? I mean, it's not like the people who get cut don't know they're going to get cut. Well, yeah. Most of them.
But Freeman's commentary in specific, I don't know about anybody else, but I actually did see the press conference question and answer on that, and that was exactly what I described. He said, I couldn't get him in.
I can't
make it work as it stands now.
Well, let's say
because he hasn't been admitted to their grad school.
Three or four articles I read all turned it around to where he was agreeing with the other guys, which is probably their fault, and you listened directly and they didn't. But all the articles got turned around to he's right on board with the SEC and the Big Ten, and you're saying he's on board for totally different reasons.
He's on board with his own opinion, and that was all he ever expressed.
Well, that's not okay.
There's no collaboration there with the Big Ten and the SEC.
Well, they didn't allude to that. They just said he was right. They made it sound like he was agreeing to the point where they didn't say they had coffee together, but it almost got that close in the one article I read.
Yeah, I don't think anybody ever asked, is there a scenario that would work in the future? Nobody asked that when he answered the question.
By the way, you and I are going about this totally different ways, but we're coming back to the same conclusion. When are these guys going to admit it's a pro league? I think it's a long way off, but it sure looks like a duck, doesn't it?
How long have I been telling you they're going to have to make them employees of the university at some point?
Well, even if they aren't, they're
going to lose in court claiming they're not. Somebody is going to, you know, it's going to be a comp claim or something like that, but somebody's going to come along and they're going to challenge whether they're eligible, for instance, for workman's comp after an injury, and they're going to win because you can claim that this is all third party, but now the schools are directly making NIL payments. So that's, you know, that's pretty interesting. That it sort of sounds like an employment arrangement, but also if they're working to arrange sponsors who will help them, if they're helping line up agreements with other third parties, then that arm's length relationship, I would say, is kind of tenuous
let's forget about football for a while, just, and let's kind of walk through, I'll use the term the law. Let's say, for instance, Ivy Tech, you know, Indiana had something bad happened to the economy. Indiana has a bad year. All of a sudden, they're going to cut all your guys' salaries or bring them down to, like, next to nothing. And I'm, like, a massive benefactor of schools. And by the way, if I had a huge amount of dough, I have a feeling your school would be one of the places I'd benefit. But let's say, wait a minute, I'm going to pay this Kevin guy $100,000 a year with the idea that he's going to go teach at Ivy Tech. Now, okay, so I pay you the $100,000 and there's some kind of contract or verbal agreement, which, by the way, counts, I think, and still does, but you're going to go and you're going to teach, you know, not every day, but whatever you do at Ivy Tech. And they say, well, we can still pay some sort of a stipend, so we'll pay $15,000, you know, okay, and I'm paying $85,000 as an outside guy. How does all that work? I mean, are you an employee? I can only pay you. Can you be employee of me and of theirs, or do I pay you at 1099? Or how does this even work?
They do endowed positions, so you would actually make your gift to the foundation or to whatever, you know, organization structure they have in there, and they would pay the endowment. So, you know, how would that work? I'm not aware of anybody getting paid by a
third party. That's what's happening in the football. I mean, Under Armour gave Hartman a whole bunch of dough to play football for Notre Dame, right? So, and then Notre Dame says, okay, well, now we're going to pony up $50,000 out of the million he's making. And I don't know what that even does. But, yeah, so he's an employee. They don't even want him as an employee. So he's an employee of nobody, right? He has no workman's comp. He has no nothing in today's world, or what?
It's an extracurricular activity, Tom. We don't have workman's comp.
But he's not an employee of Under Armour, even though he has to be at practice at a certain time. He has to be at the training table. He has to go to the game. Everything that stinks of employee, he is, of somebody. Right?
Yeah, so you're having the walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, must be a duck conversation. And that's why I said they're going to they will lose in court at some point.
Well, I guess my question is, he's an employee of whom?
I think legally he's going to wind up being an employee of the university.
Right, but right now with the deal is that he has to do something. He's gone from football, but he has to do something for Under Armour to make that allegedly legit. In other words, so he has to do some commercials. He has to do... Our girl on our basketball team has to do a couple commercials for...
Appearances at events.
Yeah, you got to do something to make it... You can't just do nothing. Although I don't know what the difference is between doing nothing and doing a little. But anyway. Crazy stuff, huh? I mean, it's... But it comes down to, you know, what are the rules? What do you think the fan base, Kevin? You know, fast forward 20 years. If it is just another professional league, how long do people lose? First of all, how far can it go? Are they going to try and draft people out of high school?
Lou said he thought so. I don't see it.
Well, you draft baseball players out of high school.
Baseball players out of high school?
Major League Baseball.
Yeah, but college baseball does not.
No, no, they don't. I'm saying.
So you're probably. Actually, you will. Somebody along the way, I just think that there's going to be, either college football is going to become totally professional. Well, it is totally professional, but it's going to be as professional on paper as it is in reality, or there's going to start being alternatives, and we see the alternatives in basketball, we see the alternatives in baseball. It's been an alternative all along, where people will actually have accepted a college scholarship only to get drafted very high by a pro team and say, okay, I'm not going to college. I'm going to take the money. I'm going to take my big signing bonus and go to Class A. So you already see that in baseball. You also see people who do go to college in baseball and play baseball and then get drafted again. They re-enter the draft after 3 years. I could envision that kind of a structure, but boy, it would be hard to create a football league. We've seen people try to create leagues competing with the NFL. And the problem is there is an emotional tie that's built into college football, and there is very little emotional tie built into there's less emotional tie built into college baseball, but there is no emotional tie to speak of tied into minor league pro baseball. They don't draw the same kind of crowds. Some of them do. I mean, some of them have good local followings. I think that, here in South Bend, it's a Cubs affiliate. When it was a Diamondbacks affiliate, I don't think it was nearly as popular as it is as a Cubs affiliate, because there's a lot of Cubs fans in the area. So, you know, that becomes part of the equation, too. What do you do to make it a revenue machine? And colleges have it, because they have a lot of alumni who are willing to spend, who are willing to show up at games and so on. And the state universities have a lot of state State U pride, you know.
How many college baseball programs think make money? There's probably a few, but it can't be very many.
It can't be. You know, there's a handful. So we know the Florida schools are really, really, really good at baseball. But Arkansas is an example of one that I absolutely know is, it's very popular. It's a big event when they have a baseball game. It's a little like Notre Dame lacrosse, believe it or not, where Notre Dame lacrosse is actually very popular on campus and locally. People go fill up. It's a small stadium, only holds a few thousand, and then there's a berm on the other side where people can throw their blankets or put up chairs and hang out. And so a lot of people like to take their kids, the kids can run loose a little bit, and they get to watch some competition. So it just depends. Can you build a business model around it that's going to make money? And right now, college has a business model that makes money. So, you know, what alternative is going to replace that? I think it's a very, very steep hill to climb.
Well, when you say that people have...
Could this erode over time with college sports? Yeah, it probably could.
Well, how much... I mean, everybody speaks, you know, for themselves. At least when I do it, I like to say I'm doing it. My affiliation with the Irish... I'd still rather them win than Alabama. I mean, I'll admit that. But it's 50% of what it used to be. It's on the way to 40, probably. I mean, at what level to where I don't even care if I watch them anymore? I'm never going to a game again, that I know. I mean, at what level does the dropping, or do some people so crazy into it? There's people that are crazy into the Bears. I mean, so it's not like... I mean, there's people who live and die by the Bears, and the Bears don't give a crap about you. I mean, duh. I mean, you'd rather see the Bears win, I guess, because your friends like to watch them, but do I really care if the Bears win? Why would I? I mean, really.
Hey, I root for them, but I'm not calling into the talk shows. I'm not doing anything extra. I don't have that kind of an emotional investment. Probably have more... emotional investment around Notre Dame just because I graduated from there.
Well, because of you guys too. I mean, it's duh. We're all friends, and some of our friends are really into it. So I'm not going to rain on their parade. I mean, and plus I like to watch them. So it's not like I'm totally lost here.
I like to watch them, and you know what I do like about their program is they are making them get educations. They they do graduate people and so on. Not every football program can make that claim. I'm happy that they do that. Are they pure as the driven snow? No, nobody is in college football anymore.
I will say that this guy Freeman, I said it right this time, I'm really impressed with him. I think that he's doing the best he can, I'll use the term, to make it sort of like it used to be, where people actually go to class and something. But if they bleep can him someday because he has a bad year and get one of these other bozos in there, I'm gone. Just saying.
Well, yeah, because I don't, you know, I think Brian Kelly complied with the university's wishes because he had to, but Brian Kelly was always, he was always seeing why it was a pain in the ass to coach for Notre Dame and what Notre Dame didn't have. And the difference is Freeman has just embraced the place as is.
Well, some of the stuff is positive. It's not all negative.
A lot of the stuff is positive, but I'll go even further and say, it's not a normal place. It's kind of got its own strange culture and strange, you know, lots of stuff
it's not that much different than
worse. But my point in bringing it up is, actually, I had a conversation with John Flanagan back when we were in college, and I was bitching about Notre Dame and everything about it. He reminded me. He said, "Kevin, whatever else you feel, this place produces a lot of really good people." And he said, "You have to acknowledge that they're going to be doing something right." And, you know, I think so. I think, I think sometimes they have gotten away from what it means to be a Catholic school, which disappoints me because one of the things I always respected, even not as a Catholic, one of the things I always respected was that they stuck by their guns on what it meant to be a Catholic school. And, you know, again, I wouldn't agree with a lot of it, but nevertheless, there was a reason to respect that. So, you know, I like those things about Notre Dame. There's a whole lot, you know, if you go visit campus and so on, there's a whole lot to like. But and some of that, you know, that's the kind of stuff that Marcus Freeman has embraced, whereas Brian Kelly just, you know, always railed against it. And plus, Freeman is
everything that happened with Kelly. Everything happened with Kelly was somebody else's fault.
Fussy.
I mean, that's his personality. Whatever happened, it was somebody else's fault.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
I mean, it didn't matter where he was.
Yeah, insufferable prick is the word that comes to mind.
I got a question more general. By the way, keep your eye peeled for
Larissa. Larissa's on now.
All right, I'll say keep your eye. I got one question that I'll lob in with Larissa because she's become our moral focus. I don't know if she wanted that job, but she sort of is. I listened to the guy who was a general manager of the Bears. The guy they hired just to essentially get him a stadium. What the hell's the guy's name?
You're thinking of Kevin Warren, the president of the Bears.
He's the African American guy.
Well, they got African American general manager too.
So. Well, one of them came on talking about the stadium, and you know, Kevin, and Larissa and Ricky and listeners, this whole idea that people every time they come up with something, they have to lie like a friggin' rug. The guy comes on, and it's not lying in the sense that they're telling you it's daylight when it's nighttime, but they allege so much stuff in there that just isn't. He starts talking about the stadium, and he's talking about how it's all for the fans. And I'm thinking, all right, where's this one going? It starts launching into this huge dissertation about we need to have concerts for our fans. Now, me being the money man and Larissa being the economics professor might say, oh, does that mean a seat license includes tickets to a concert? I'm thinking the answer is no. Duh. I mean, he starts lobbing all this stuff out there, and it's all for the fans, yet the Bear fan doesn't participate in it at all. That's all for them. It's not for the fan. I don't know. It's not exactly a lie, but it sure is bearing false witness, and I don't know what the difference is. Or they don't know what the difference is. Can anybody just tell the straight truth? We want a new place so we can make more money. We want you to pay for it. Duh. I mean, that wouldn't be a big marketing campaign, but it is the truth, right?
It is the truth. And my 5-year-old is starting a petition to save Soldier Field.
You do know it's not a landmark anymore. They lost the landmark status.
He is working hard. So far, he's gotten six people willing to sign his petition.
Well, the thing of it is, I mean, you're the economics professor. This is America. If you want to build a stadium, find 50,000 idiots. They're going to buy a $100,000 seat license. That's $5 billion. Build the damn place. Go ahead, knock yourself out. It is America, right? But nobody wants to do that. They want us to pay for it. It's a nice world.
Okay, before we get away from it, though, I've given you a Notre Dame fan perspective. And, Larissa, I'm not sure how much you're into Purdue football or not. But how do you feel that the head coach, that Barry Odom, is... has sort of embraced, because I've been to Purdue enough times to know that it has its own unique culture too, and you know, is a really good educational institution. It seems to me a coach has to come in and figure out how to thrive in there and how to navigate the place, and I don't know that some of the previous ones did, and Odom's from UNLV, so that's got a little bit different culture of its own. Do you have any feeling for how connected Odom is to the university, and how connected the football program is to the university?
Well, right now I have some football player in my class, and I feel fairly confident that most people respect Odom on campus, but I could just be looking at a very small subset and not understanding the greater campus, you know, across the board.
Okay. Can I ask that another way, Kevin?
Talk about Pat Painter and his embracing the university. He's an alum, so yes, he's all on board with it.
Kevin, can I ask that question slightly different? During the NCAAs, and correct me if I'm wrong, one of the color commentators said something about, if you want to be a real team in NCAA basketball now, you need a budget of $10 million. I think that was a number, wasn't it? Or am I off? It was either 5 or 10 or 15, but let's say 10. I'm going to say that number just off the bottom of my ass for football is probably in the neighborhood of 50 to 60. I'm thinking for as the budget, maybe more. What would you guess?
Oh, it's a big number. I don't even know.
Let's pick 60.
I saw the athletic director giving a speech at reunion, and he was saying that he thinks the number for the school to administer just the NIL, which is about 20, it was 20 and a half million last year. It's going to go up a little this year. And he thinks that number needs to be 50 to 60 plus. And his reasoning behind that was, for better or for worse, is that these third-party NIL deals are so disruptive to everything they do and such a pain in the neck, and that they would be diminished by having the school have more funding to share with the players so that they wouldn't go out and seek that. I don't agree, by the way. I think they'll want... I'd take more money from the school and still want to pursue sponsorship deals and so on. I'd still want to do all of that. But the reason I say that in answer to your question, that isn't even anything to... It doesn't have anything to do with the operating budget. That's just telling you what the compensation budget is. So imagine what the operating budget is. I mean, you start thinking, well, I got an operated stadium. I've got all the logistics and all of the expense of packing up my team and taking them on the road. You just get into those things, and those numbers are astronomical. And that coaches' salaries are really huge. So that's big budget.
All right, well, just
over $100 million. I think.
Make believe I'm Belushi here and roll with me. Let's say the number is 75. Now, when the $10 million, this is directed at Larissa. Well, all of us really. The number was $10 million for basketball. I lobbed that out to two of my friends, one of which is Marquette, and one was DePaul, and they were kind of struggling with that number as to whether the Big East teams really wanted to be all in with that in basketball. Now, if it's, let's say it's 75 mil, let's pick a number out of the air. Obviously Alabama's in on it, Georgia's in on it, Illinois's in on it, Michigan's in on it, Ohio State's in on it. Notre Dame is, I think, going to do their best they can to be there. What about Purdue? What about Iowa? What about Iowa State? I mean, are all these teams in at that kind of number? Purdue is not Ohio State. I mean, it's a great place, and we have some great professors that we know of, but it's not Ohio State. It's not Michigan.
Ohio State in terms of funding, except that part of its relationship with the Big Ten is also participation in a research symposium. And they get a whole lot of grant money and a lot of research dollars via.
This is not a disparaging thing at all against Purdue. What I'm saying is, if the number is $100 million, how does Purdue compete with Ohio State? How do the Irish? Well, I guess they maybe can, but how does Northwestern with their new?
I don't think they've been spending comparable to other schools. I think they're in the lower third, maybe the lower 25% of the ACC in basketball.
I'm getting to my question for Larissa. Is there a number there where Purdue might say, we'll take the second tier?
I don't think so. Purdue's mission statement is excellence. So they are focused on excellence in any aspect that they're going to participate.
Okay.
So I don't think that they'd be willing to take a second tier.
Well, when you look at the revenue numbers of these schools, and Kevin's right, they're splitting up the TV revenue, which is becoming a bigger thing. But I don't see how Northwestern with 35,000 seat stadium competes straight up with Ohio State or Michigan. How do you? Unless you grab all the money from education, which I don't know if anybody would want. It's becoming a to the extent that you look at it all, to me, it's a multifaceted. It's almost like deregulating the trucking. It's interesting to see where this is going to go economically. I mean, how high end are the high end schools going to be? I mean, at some point, can Eastern Illinois, you know, play Alabama without everybody getting hurt. You know, I don't know, what do you think of that? I mean, I'm scrambling all over. What's your view? So just from the top down.
You know, I really haven't thought a whole lot about the economics behind college basketball, and I apologize for that.
Well, no, it's interesting on an economic level when you see essentially a new industry. It's a new pro league, for God's sake. And it's working its way through, so it's kind of fascinating. I think there's probably 30 PhD papers rolling around in here somewhere.
I don't know.
Yeah,
they'd be fun
PhD
papers to write.
Yeah. To me, it's very similar to deregulating the airlines, deregulating trucking. It's all of a sudden, it's a whole new world. And then see how it plays out through the courts, through here, through Congress, through the presidency, through everywhere. I mean, everybody's got an opinion on how it ought to go, right?
There's a lot of opinions that want, you know, status quo ante. So, and we're not going back to the way it was. It's not going to happen. So, you talk about there's a nostalgia aspect to it, and why can't we just do it the way we used to do it? Well, you can ask that question all you want, but we ain't going back.
Well, but you're saying
my sense for Purdue in basketball. Purdue, you know, that's a rallying point of pride. Purdue's got a great basketball program. And, I know a lot of people in central Indiana who are huge Purdue fans. So it's not just the school itself. It's not just the student body. It's not just the alumni. I think there's, you know, it's a big deal, especially since Indiana University, has been down. A lot of people have caught Purdue fever in basketball. And I think that state affiliation is part of, you know, when I said at the beginning that if you're going to go completely professional, or if you want to create a professional alternative, like, you know, like the NBA has with the G League, like baseball has with the minor leagues, how are you going to make it pay compared to college football? Because college football has emotional ties built into being a fan, and you know, as does being a Bears fan. Right.
Well, my question was really not directed at Purdue's basketball. I know they're all in there. I was thinking more of, are they in for the $100 million in football? And Larissa sort of answered that, saying whatever it takes. I think when you say we, Kevin, again, we can walk on to some other subject, but when you say we, we're talking about the top 60 teams. Do the other 150 drop back to what it used to be and say we're just not going there? Or we can't go there?
You might have some, and certainly there are a lot of universities who participate in lower-level divisions, and it is the way it used to be.
But I'm not so sure where the Big East lands.
They make it work. Yeah. You know, they make it work. They're not feeding the NFL or anything like that on a regular basis. Occasionally somebody will make it out of a smaller school, a lesser program, but that's not their point. They really do run it like it's an extracurricular activity, like it's something to do on campus for the students. You know, all of those kinds of aspects of the program, which is the old way it used to be once upon a time.
Well, University of Chicago is sure the old way. No doubt about that. Yeah. So, Larissa, what are the big topics? Have you guys started yet?
We have started.
What does your new gang look like? You've got juniors and freshmen, right?
I do, and quite a few seniors.
Really?
So I'm very pleased. In a couple of my classes, I have a lot of students that I've had before, which makes teaching them, it's just so much more fun because you've already developed a relationship, and then you can get to better discussions more quickly. So that's been a lot of fun. We've been discussing the K economy quite a bit, and I think you'll find this, I don't know, I was a little shocked when one of my students said this. We were talking about the disparity in the K economy, and one student said, well, if this continues to go, history has demonstrated that people will eventually revolt and kill everybody in the top half of the economy.
Well, let's hope we don't kill everybody. Is this Carl's grandson? Who is this kid?
Join the conversation here. Yeah.
Did Carl join in from a kid he like cloned 10 years ago or what?
Indeed.
what are What are the three classes you're teaching the freshmen, juniors, and seniors?
I am teaching a survey of finance using Excel. That's for the freshmen. And then I'm teaching investments.
That's and both at the junior level and senior level, or just seniors in the class?
Juniors and seniors in the class.
Okay, well, it must be nice for people who have picked you twice. That means they liked you the first time.
Well, a couple of people I've had three or four times.
Wow. I actually had a couple of professors.
I don't know if it has anything to do with they like me versus I'm the only one who teaches it in the program.
You schedule the right course at convenient times, huh?
Yeah.
There were a couple of people at Notre Dame that I made sure I went and got twice. They were that good. It's, you know, it's same thing at the University of Chicago. What did you say to this kid?
A thought, because, you know, Larissa, you might have some tips for me. I have one class that is mostly freshmen, I have not typically had classes like that. So it's interesting. What I like about it is, you know, as department chair, I tell them this is your opportunity to get to know your department chair, who can advocate for you when necessary. And that, you know, you're able to tap into, you know, you're able to tap into me when you need help with something, when you need resources, when you need me to point you in the right direction, and so on. So that part of it's really great. But it is interesting. And, you know, I have a couple of special needs, and, you know, which I've had before, and that's always interesting, with accommodations. Then on Wednesdays, I have a different class that is all working adults and people who have been working for decades in most cases. And then I'll see what I have tomorrow. Tomorrow morning. That'll probably be a bit of a mix.
Well, I really don't usually work with freshmen, so I think this might be my first time as well. So you and I are in the same boat. What I'm finding with my freshmen is it's a completely online class, and I've been spending a lot of time teaching how to use the learning management system.
This is from a guy who's a dopo in regards to this. Why, if everybody's living on campus, do you need an online class?
Because there are 425 students in that class.
Ah, okay. That'll do it. All right. How many rooms do you have that can hold 425 people?
425 students, right.
Yeah. So the kid who wanted to kill everybody, was he a freshman or a junior?
That was a junior. I was blown away by the comment, and, you know, we're nowhere near that in our economy. But the student had a point that we can't continue on this trajectory where we're creating these haves and have-nots, and something needs to be done to rectify that, because we don't want a situation like the French Revolution. We want our society to be productive and cohesive. It was, again, I was quite surprised by the statement.
A couple weeks ago you weren't on, but I had a conversation that weekend. I ran it by Carl and Kevin. Just happened to be landing with a couple of younger people, one being my nephew, but one being a young lady who's, well, she's very bright. But anyway, she was talking about, taxation and you know, you got to tax the rich and this and the other stuff. And it's more than just, it's a combination of sort of two things. You can't tax anybody else because nobody else got any money. So it's almost like the, you know, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is argument. But the difference, and I don't know, when I was growing up and you saw people that had more money than everybody else, you got the impression, especially if you knew them, that they sort of earned it. You know, they took the risk, they bought the company, they did something that nobody else did, and that's why they had more money. Most of these people now, I mean, most is a big word, because you and Kevin talk to more than I do, it seems the impression is that the uber-rich, not necessarily, you know, the guy down the block that bought Apple at the right time, the uber rich, the Musks of the world, and those kind of people, they did it on somebody else's back. They didn't get there because they were Jonas Salk or Thomas Edison. They got there because they found a way for the government to send them a check. They really don't feel there's an overriding thing that they didn't earn it. And I think that's where your kid, even though he didn't say that, I bet if you'd had a long time to have a cup of coffee with him, that would have popped out of his head. He doesn't really think they should have that much money. It's not like, you know, somebody invented a cure for God knows what, you know, something like that, or invented an invention where nobody died or something. They don't think that the rich people now necessarily earned it. They connived it. Is that a part of this, you think?
You know, I can't speak to that. I hadn't thought about the students viewing other people that way. So I don't know. And again, it's a little bit of a challenge because we talk when we're discussing this, they're Purdue students. And theoretically, when they graduate from Purdue, they're going to have very good jobs. They're going to be able to support themselves. So they themselves might end up on the top part of the K. And I don't think they thought about through that part of it as well, as where are they going to land? What are they going to do? So it's an interesting conversation with them, especially for the students who haven't had me before, because they don't know my opinions or my thoughts or my beliefs on this. But I was also just pleased that the students were discussing this and that they were participating in this conversation and starting to think more deeply about the impact of what's happening. And the reason why I brought up this topic in the class was we were discussing the interest rate risk on the ability for households to save money. So I was discussing some of the challenges households currently have right now to save excess money because their consumption is so high relative to their income. And I know this is something that we've discussed multiple times in this program, is that how if you've got sticky wages that aren't going up, you've got prices going up, and I love your example, you're one transmission away from going into debt. What do those people do?
Well, that's why you have loan officers now in the repair part of an auto dealer.
Right.
Yeah, but I will say this, my take on, like, most working class people, they don't necessarily have a problem with wealthy people. There is an attitude that a whole lot of wealthy people went out and earned it.
Right.
And there's no problem there. Their bigger problem is saying, I have this college person, this college education person who comes into my employment, where I work, and doesn't know a darn thing about, doesn't know a darn thing about how to do my job, but has no problem telling me how to do it. That's where people get really resentful. And, you know, it is what you've talked about in the past, Tom, where you're talking about management class. I think that's where the bigger problem is aimed at that.
Well, the one conversation I had was a little different. It was a family member, but, you know, that happens. He basically said, I can handle, and he's a guy who works in a blue-collar job where he does a lot of these big, long story, I don't know if I'll tell it, but it's these big firms that have, not big firms, but manufacturing facilities that have the machines that essentially, break down that are 30 years old. Well, he knows how to take the parts, use all the new machines, and make new parts from stuff. That's what their place does. And he says, I can understand somebody running a place making 10 times more than me or 20. He goes, but the guy making 1,000 times more than me, I think he needs to prove that he, like, did something, like he invented something, that he just didn't land in there, and because he's a CEO, make, like, $5 million a year when he didn't even do anything yet.
I mean, and that's not an unusual sentiment at all, even among working classes. You know, when I say, you know, they earned it, you're talking about people who started up, and in many cases, you know, I'm thinking locally where they started up manufacturing, plants or manufacturing businesses, and they're doing a lot, but they started them up 30 years ago, made a hell of a lot of money doing it, and live really, really well. Yeah, there isn't resentment of that.
Oh, I hope not. That's the American way, right?
Yeah, but you also have another disaffected class of people, and that's college graduates that are finding out that whatever promise of employment they thought they had, and whatever optimism that they've had coming out of school has been dashed because they can't get jobs. And we've seen that, you know, Carl can comment on that. We've seen it in the monthly jobs numbers, where the people getting hit as bad as anyone are college graduates. And, you know, there's a lot of resentment there because I was promised something. I was promised that if I work hard, got into college, went to college and got my degree, I would get a good job and I would live well. And now they're finding out not necessarily true.
Well, it's last night, actually just last night, I was with a gentleman, and he's, listen, I'm going to go, I think he said his 26th birthday, or maybe 27th. Nice kid. Works for, Market Reg or someplace at the SIBO. And I'm guessing he's 60, 62 grand, he's making something along those lines. Has a lot of student loan debt, you know, shares like a garden apartment with somebody. No, we'll tell you right to your face, no chance ever buying a new car. I don't know how I could even date somebody, much less get married and have any kids. No way I'm getting a house. And he went to a, I don't know if the school is as good as Purdue, but it was a pretty good school, and he did okay, got good grades, and here's where he is. And he's in Market Reg. It's not like he's working for a trading firm where he can learn how to trade and actually become a trader someday or something. But the kid thinks he has zero future. And he's a good kid, and he's smart. He shows up every day, works overtime when they need it. I mean, he's just locked in. I think he, I don't even want to say what he does in case somebody might hear it, but he does, like, I think the currency marking at night or something. Well, hell, he's going to be doing that when he's 60. I mean, that.
Remember, we had, it was official policy, and I think it was wrong-headed at the time, and I've said that on the air here. But if we go back to the Obama administration, the official policy, one of the policy directions of that administration was that everybody should go to college. And I have no problem, I think it could be a noble goal, but, the fact is, not everybody should go to college. Or maybe college can wait for a while you get your footing as an individual. I mean, there's a lot of other paths, and those paths were, almost by official policy dismissed, that everybody should be going to their college, and here we will loan you the money to do it.
Well, and we also loan people the money. We also loan people the money at 6-7% while we're paying our people 2% for how many years? And that was Obama. That was Trump. That was everybody.
I mean, that is a major shift that you've seen, is where trade development has become a priority now for the economy, and I think that's not a bad place to be. Where the right place to be ultimately would be neutral on that, and let people gravitate in whatever direction makes sense for them. But right now we are pushing manufacturing skills, because we're trying to bring manufacturing back into the United States, and if we're going to do that, the way to do it is going to be to have people develop manufacturing skills, thus workforce Pell grants and things like that. And Indiana's been doing that for a long time. Indiana started that back in the 2008-09 time frame, where they had the Workforce Ready grant, and that's actually getting curtailed a little bit.
What's the we just had a summer, we just started the fall semester. Larissa, if you had a guess, the seniors that graduated last year in stuff like, I guess if you're in computers or electrical engineering or something, what was the, if you could guess, what was the crowd of interviewers? Were people swamped with recruiters after graduation or before graduation, or I graduated in 74, and that was about the crummiest year ever. I think the only person who got an interview was Bob Gold, Kevin. I don't know if anybody else got one. Do you? Everybody fled to grad school or did something, but a couple guys' parents owned places and they went there. One of our friends' his dad owned an insurance company, went to work for him, but. I don't know of anybody that interviewed anybody except for maybe in accounting. Do you? I mean, what was it like, Lewis? What would you think it was like this year? Were kids able to get jobs?
Oh, they were able to get jobs.
Okay.
And I've seen the career fairs that Purdue has. They're huge. The number of companies that want to be there is substantial. They have a system where if your company, you want to come to campus to recruit, and again, they sell out, you have to pay to have a booth.
Wow.
And they sell out.
Yeah. So, I mean, is that people looking for specific engineering people or just...
To the job market in central Indiana, which is real heavy in manufacturing, really heavy in distribution, and has seen tremendous growth over the last, you know, my observation over the last 10 years in those functions. And so there are engineering jobs available. There are management level, management trainee. There are logistics jobs. All those kinds of things are available in there, as well as the people that we're producing out of our Lafayette campus at Ivy Tech, who are ready to go be supervisors on the production line.
Larissa, was that even across the board? Could you guess, or was it mostly? I'm not leading the witness here, but was it because they're snapping up engineering students, or was there? Three booths looking for economics students?
I saw a lot of, engineering.
Okay.
And I couldn't speak to the business students because last year I wasn't involved with the business school. So I quite candidly did not pay attention to what was happening over in the business school.
Well, nothing could be worse than mine. Get a little of this, the University of Chicago. If a company wanted to come in and do a job fair, they made them buy like 5 kegs of beer and have a party on a Friday night, and we got to drink at least for the place. They couldn't.
That doesn't happen now.
But everybody was in grad school, so everybody was 21. You get away with it. But that's what they did. And they'd bring in like 20 people and go. So the trick was, if it was a firm you absolutely didn't want to. Be with you, go have a few beers, and every time somebody came near you, you had some other place to go and not talk to anybody. So, I don't know if that was the intention of that, but so the what did the rest of the class say to this kid who wanted to kill everybody?
Oh, no, he didn't want to. The student didn't say that they wanted to kill anybody, they just said if the disparity continues, that there will be a revolution in the bottom half of the K.
In 29, the top part just fell apart. I don't know if I sent it to you. I probably didn't, but I listened to this YouTube thing. It was, you listen to stuff, and it's, like Kevin says, you don't... But it was pretty interesting, because the guy was drawing some parallels between the 1929 crash and what he sees sort of happening here.
Who was the speaker, do you know?
I don't know. I got it somewhere. I'm sure I have it in my... But... You know, who knows? The guy might, but you know, I don't really care who the guy is. I just look for it. If it looks like there's some facts in there to make sense that I can verify, then I roll with it. But the thing that caught me, Larissa, on the economic side, and I'm not going to point for one little thing, but his point was if you let things go too far, he said, like in 1929, and he's not making a. He's not taking a shot at anybody in government right now. He just said, when you let things go too far, and he was talking about the amount of speculation in the economy, and the Federal Reserve let the money supplies, essentially in terms of stocks, just blow up to the point where there was 90% margin, which we don't have now. Although you can sort of get pretty close to it on the futures side. So it's not all 50% up. Like if somebody wants to buy a stock here at PTI, you got to pony up half of it. And oh, by the way, you don't come up with more money until it gets down to 30%. So there's a slide there on the security side that's way better than in 1929, not even close. But now you have future sides, and once you get down to 30%, you are dollar for dollar back where you were in 1929. So anyway, I already went into two more than I had to. But his point was, if you let things go too far, like if they let so much money pour into the system. That one day, if the Federal Reserve wakes up and says, "Wait a minute, we need to bring the margin rates from 90% you can borrow to like 85%, something that makes incredible sense and was probably way overdue," he said, "once you get into this abyss, even a rational move to pull it back is enough to actually cause the problem." Or not cause the problem, cause the crash. And so his point is, if you I mean, now today, if you keep, you know, pouring money into the system to the point where, you know, some of these companies, and I'm not going to give investment advice, they're 45, 50 times revenue. We're not talking to some of these, I mean, and some of them are probably great buys here, but they can't all be unless, you know, the economy's going to triple. So his point was, all of a sudden, if you get to that point, and all of a sudden the Fed one day says, you know, we're not going to grow at 7% anymore, that's crazy, let's pull it back to 2%. Even though that makes all the sense in the world, if you're over this, quote, line, that's going to cause the problem. Or if you go back to a 10% reserve requirement, which why we're down to zero, I have no idea. But he says, but if it gets that low, and then you make even the intelligent thing, that's enough to cause it. And you know, I don't know this guy from Adam, but I never thought of it that way. And you know what? I think he might be right. That if you're way over the top, if you say, okay, nobody pays back anybody, and you say, well, wait a minute, you got to pay back like 2% a year. That he says, if you're so far out there, that's enough to cause the problem. I never thought of that. What do you think of that? I know I'm just jumping on you with it. I wonder if he's right. That even if you decide to do something rational, if you really got out of over your skis, that even that's going to cause the problem.
I think what you're saying is that you get beyond the point where you could create a glide path and get back to where you need.
The very, very short way of saying what I just said for 2 minutes, 10 minutes. But yeah,
and I think that's true. And we talked about that. I even remember we went back to pandemic days and said, let's just make the assumption that we need to do all these crazy things that we're doing. And that's, you know, that's a leap, but that's a different discussion. And let's just say we do it. It is our irresponsible management of the federal budget all along that says this is going to be a killer when we do it, as opposed to we could have been at the point where we said, we have to spend these trillions of dollars, and we can chart a path to get back on track. And to do it over a period of years, and maybe at the end of 10 years, it'll all be back, you know, back where we need it to be. We don't have a glide path built into anything we do anymore. And you're right, you know, whatever we do is going to touch it off. And Carl's talked about this all the time. We are kind of at the point of no return on this stuff.
I think what do you view on this? Are you on the? I mean, we've got these numbers that are so bizarre, and the debt numbers. And we have, you know, I'll tell you what the difference, there's a big difference in terms of somebody asked Milton Friedman one day, and the other guys have heard this, I don't know if you have, what do you think about the national debt? And he said, I don't worry about it. And somebody says, well, why is that? And so you've got a government that essentially owes money to their people. It's the same thing as, you know, the old man spending the dough and owing the wife money. He goes, the house is flat. And if you look at your country like a house, you know, but in his mind, again, this was a long time ago, in his mind, you were talking about, you know, the nice-looking ladies running out and sending war bonds during World War II, where people worked, made some money, bought the war bonds to finance the war. He goes, in that instance, you don't worry about it because it's the government owing their own people. Now, if you had to yank him out of his grave today and put a spark on him like Frankenstein, and if you were to say, well, what if 50% of the money you owe is from overseas, I have a feeling that the answer would be quite a bit different. Do you?
It might be different. I hadn't thought about that, but that's a good point, that this isn't just taxpayers' dollars. I mean, it's taxpayers' dollars, but we're no longer just working with each other or working with ourselves internally.
Well, when you look at the move that Bessent made a few weeks ago, and I'm not necessarily criticizing, I know why he did it. The Japanese, because of oil prices up, the Japanese are having trouble. Their currency was going down, so they have to buy dollars to buy oil. And oil's going up, and their currency's going down, so they're basically getting screwed twice. And they're having a panic. And now, why do we care? Well, you care because they're an ally, I guess, but why would we care? You care because the money that they were using to buy, to prop up the yen, they were selling U.S. treasuries. And oh, by the way, we owe them $1.1 trillion. Well, now that's a problem, and that's why I think Besant, and probably rightfully so, I mean, it's a stopgap measure, went out and bought a bunch of yen to prop the price of the yen up to stop the Japanese from having to sell U.S. treasuries to buy them back themselves. Now, that's a massive trick bag that I'm sure very few people even understand. I think you do because you're an economics professor, but you probably never thought it through that way either because that's not what you're teaching. But you sit there, how long can we do that? I mean, we essentially give people money to turn around and buy our bonds back because we need somebody to buy them. I mean, that's a zero-sum game. But a lot of the trick bags that Kevin's just talking about, I don't even think we know we're in yet with this kind of debt. I mean, when you walk through, and when somebody asks you a question about that, how do you even answer something like that?
So this has happened multiple times in the past with other countries. So, for example, Argentina is notorious for this, and they've struggled quite a bit with keeping their currency price up because one of their techniques for manipulating their currency was to sell off U.S. debt or sell off any debt that they own from the U.S. The problem that Argentina ran into is that at some point you run out of U.S. treasuries to sell off, and so then their economy started to collapse. So this type of thing happens actually fairly frequently with different countries. It's unique that it's happening to Japan because it's such a large economy. Argentina is obviously a developing country economically, so they're in a different boat. But again, these types of tricks and techniques are utilized. They might not get the attention of other things that are happening in the markets, but this goes on frequently.
There was a...
Folks, this is a good cue for Carl to get in and join the conversation, and I need to jump out. So you guys, the three of you, should keep going with it because I think you're going to get some good perspectives from each other. And I don't really have a lot to offer on currency stuff anyway. So I need to jump out. I will see you all.
Kevin, you got that big wad of currency in your pocket. You could offer that.
Well, yeah. And you know what? I could probably bail somebody out for about 40 seconds.
God. Anyway, have a good weekend, buddy.
Bye, Kevin.
Bye.
It's interesting. Boy, talk about, you know, things I remember, Larissa and Carl. I think I was either in grad school or just out of it. And we, the U.S. of A., somebody had lent a bunch of money to Argentina. And you're absolutely correct that it seems like it happens like once a decade down there, doesn't it? And somehow or another, they were broke. Well, not somehow or another, they were broke. But the people that lent them the money, the U.S., gave them a new loan, and they used the money to pay back the old loan, right? So, duh. But the weird part of it was they used the new money to send it back to the same people with the old loans on there, and they branded some of it as interest, and people actually took it to income instead of just saying, thank God we got paid back. They took some of it to income and actually showed a profit on it. You couldn't write fiction like that, could you?
Well, Chief, think about what just happened with NVIDIA.
Yeah.
Okay. And you want to know where all this insane credit emission winds up.
Hold on for a second. I'm going to catch Larissa up on one of the things that Carl and I have going on NVIDIA, Larissa, is that they seem to be in a mode of either buying companies or loaning money to companies to buy their stuff, and that's a real dangerous game. And Carl and I have been kind of on it. I just wanted to bring you up to speed on what we're talking about here.
So
sorry, Carl.
Here's the latest iteration of this. Okay, I mean, NVIDIA is a very large company, a $5 trillion market cap or something like that. All right, so their earnings report comes out now. Their TTM
25 billion shares, 226. So do the math. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Their earnings report comes out, and their 12-month trailing revenue is in the $200-ish billion range, which is a really large number, right? But that's not the quarterly revenue. That's the last 12 months consecutively. So it's the last four quarters. Okay. Buried in their financial statements is the fact that in the last quarter, not over the last year, but in the last quarter, they backed $100 billion worth of their customers' credit. That's $400 billion a year.
I'm going to lend you money to buy my stuff. Where could that go wrong?
By the way, it's considerably more than their entire revenue for the quarter and for the year.
Well, the revenue. The revenue per share is 10.42 trailing. Stock's trading 2.27. So we're talking 21 times revenue for a company that size. That's a huge number.
Chief, it's much worse than that. Okay, because yes, that's.
I know. I'm just labbing it out there. I'm just setting this.
The problem with all of this crediting mission, and at the federal level, we know where it's all coming from. It's coming from one place. All right, it's all in CMS. Every last nickel of the deficit, plus another 30%, is there. All right? That's the data from the MTS. And I predicted in the 1990s this was going to happen if we kept this up, what we were doing at the time. And we have kept it up. Double-digit percentage increases every single year. Nowhere have we seen double-digit percentage increases in GDP.
Oh, God, no.
All right. Yeah, not happening.
Well, if you count inflation in there, we're trying.
Well, okay. I'm talking about nominal, okay?
Yeah.
We're not even talking about real GDP. All right, but here's the problem with this. The company, and they make, look, I have one of their cards in my computer here on my desk I'm talking to you through, all right? They make nice equipment. No argument there. It's not that, like, the company makes garbage. They don't. They make good gear. But in the last, at today's run rate, in last quarter's run rate, they will have, if they continue this, they will have put $400 billion worth of credit guarantees against $250 billion of revenue. Not profit, revenue.
I don't know
how now that's a Ponzi scheme. I don't care how you slice it.
I don't know how people even think of something like that, to be honest with you. Larissa, you following us? What do you make of this?
I am following all of this, and I can see how they are able to justify it because so many other companies do this. It's not dramatically that different than Macy's passing out a credit card.
Oh yes, it is different.
Okay, please tell me how.
Go find instances where a firm has off balance sheet. It's in the footnotes, but it's off their balance sheet.
Got it.
Has put almost double their revenue number on their sheet as guaranteed debt over a 12-month period, and gotten away with it for more than about a week.
I think a little bit of the difference, Larissa, and you're right. I think Macy's makes the call that they're spreading it around 200,000 people. The NVIDIAs of the world, what's their? And we're not talking
by,
down.
By,
we're,
by the way, we're, by how, the way what most per- of this. Yeah, Chief, by the way, most of this is across four customers.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the problem. It's four customers. I mean, I'm not talking the company down. I mean, they've been a huge, growth kind of thing. But just the numbers, we've been kicking this one around. Larissa, I don't expect you to be up on these stocks because I'm not really. But Palantir, it's amazing the difference in point of view. Kenny Pulcheri was on last week, and Kenny's he's been talking to the New York Stock Exchange forever. He's a terrific guy and very, very bright. And he's a guy that is a Wall Street guy. And when I say that, this kind of leads into kind of a different world that I see us in. Palantir comes out with their earnings, and the stock shoots up. It shoots up like a huge number. And he goes, they blew out their revenue numbers. And they're up to $3.50 a share going forward. Well, last year they were $2.60, and the stock is trading. Where the hell is it? I'm going to say it's like 100 and something bucks. I mean, it's like 40 some times revenue. So even though, but the weird part, and this, you know, maybe I'm showing my age here, when companies were really in a growth mode when I first started the business, you'd see a company like run up before earnings. Now, who knows if they were leaked or whatever, but they come out with these incredible numbers. Well, the day they come out, the stock pretty much doesn't do anything because, you know, it was what, it was buy the rumor, sell the news. But now Palantir runs up into essentially the earnings number. The earnings number comes up, and now we're talking stock trading 185, and the revenue per share is 350 next year, not last year. So what are we talking? 50 times earnings, for God's sake? That's 40 times revenue. Then the stock runs up from there. It's like there's no, you know, the best thing that you could possibly have bet on happened, and yet the price goes up from there. It just, it seems odd to me, and it has to be something, I think, with the amount of money we're pouring in. I mean, there's so much money to go around, or you don't even look at the price anymore. Is that just me being grumpy? I don't know. Lewis, please answer. I mean, these prices are way higher than they were at the 2000 crash by any estimate. And yet, here we are. And guess what? I'm bullish. I don't see it stopping anytime soon. Do you? I mean,
I don't see things stopping. And yes, prices are higher.
I'm talking about stock prices.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, especially because 2019, 2020, 2021, 2022, 2023, 2024 were stupendous years. So you've got that compounding impact. So 2026 isn't as great of a year, but it's still going up quite a bit. I think we're projected for, what, 13% return for this year?
I think it'd be better. It's going to be more than that. I think they're going to pour so much money in between now and the election. It's going to be amazing.
Huge. I mean, right. And so to your point, stock prices have gone up dramatically, and there does not seem to be a way to slow down the economy.
Well, when you say slow down, what's it going to take? Because you're teaching people. What's it going to take for enough people in this country to realize that the dollar debasement doesn't benefit people? I know we're all from the Midwest. I don't know where we got Carol from, but we're all from the Midwest, and we still to this day, even if we are either economics professors or we know something about economics or think we do, look at the dollar in your pocket and you think it's a storehouse of value. Even though for the last, since 1968, damn near, they've told us over and over again it's not. Yet we still believe it. What's it going to take for us to wake up collectively? I mean, you can, I don't think, and by the way, you're the one who set me on this when you talked about going to the store, and now you're spending more than last year and getting less. And I remember it vividly, like every word you said that day. Now, every time I see these numbers that come out and they talk about retail sales are here, something's here, everything's going great, all of a sudden I get this vision of you in my head. Yeah, but if you listen to this, Larissa, of course the numbers look good. That doesn't mean anybody's healthy. Of course they look. They're always going to look good. I mean, how long are we going to keep perpetuating this? They always look good, and they sound great no matter which administration's in there. Yet at the end of the day, yes, somebody, by the way, you're doing better than last year? Well, hell no. How long can we push that? I mean, when is your, I guess, ask your student, when's this going to happen?
Right. When is the revolt?
I mean, I guess, you know, is it going to be at the ballot box? I mean, how do you separate, what if the Democrats all, you know, win the House and the Senate? I don't know what that even means. What's the message there? I mean, I guess people aren't doing as well as they thought they would, but now are we in a sleaze bag here where every 4 years we throw whoever was in there before out, hoping the new guy can do better and he does the same thing, and then we do that again another 4 years? That doesn't look like a bleak future. That's a bleak future, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. And I'll be curious to see how things change, especially with... I'll just be curious to see how things change and see if any current politicians attempt to stay in office longer than they already are.
Well, there's going to be, I think there might be a kind of a flip over. A couple guys have died, you know, so they're not coming back.
Sure.
You know, I don't even know what, if there's a flip, I don't even know what that means.
Well, I don't think it means anything, Chief, because, you know, you take, just here's just one really serious example of this that I put an article up on a couple of days ago. You just had this new drug that got FDA approval, okay, for pancreatic cancer. This is the same movie that we watched with Dendrion back around the time of the crash, which I started writing on before the blow-up in 2008 because I was following the company back then. You know, it takes years for
drugs. What was the Dendrion thing? I remember the name.
Dendrion was a company. They had a drug called Provenge, which they developed for metastatic prostate cancer. And it was an immunotherapy, so they drew your blood.
I wish it would have worked. I have a couple of friends who'd still be here.
Well, it'd be really nice if it did. Okay, and I was in a lot of this stuff during the crash period because I was looking for things that I could have as longs that actually would make some sense. All right. You know, that's what happens when everything seems to be going down, right? Is you're looking, you'd like to have some balance in what you're doing.
Do I have one winner in here?
Yeah, can I find a winner somewhere, right? So, I mean, this was one that came, and I've paid a lot of attention to biologics and drug development for a long time because I'm not one of the people that failed organic chemistry, right? So I can actually look at their mechanism of action and say, yeah, that's plausible. You know, it doesn't mean necessarily it's going to work, but it's plausible. So anyway, this was one of the companies that came up in that period of time, and I followed it very closely. The infusion set cost $100,000 approximately. I think it was like 94 or something like that. Here's the problem. When the data finally drops, you got 4.1 months median of life out of using the therapy, and then you died anyway. All right? Now, what that basically meant is that the cost per year of life that somebody got out of this thing was about $300,000, roughly. Medicare refused to cover it.
Right.
All right? And as soon as they did that, the company crashed, it blew up, and ultimately went out of business. They used to be publicly traded, DNDN, not anymore.
By the way, I'm very familiar with this because my mother died of cancer, and we went through a lot of so.
Well, okay, now, here's where it gets ugly. This new one that the FDA just approved is... you can't make this kind of stuff up. It's $40,000 a month, about $1,300 a pill. It's a one-a-day pill.
Wait a minute. We got to send Larissa down to the Andes or someplace and wrestle the molars out of an alligator to make this stuff, or what?
Chief, I don't know. All right, I'm just telling you. And this is, by the way, that's the wholesale cost. So that's before anybody makes any money on it. Okay, it's a wholesale cost from the drug company. It gives, by the data, 6 months, and then you die anyway. Now,
well, you can say that for any medicine, you're going to die anyway.
Well, no, you die of the original condition.
All right.
You die of the pancreatic cancer. Okay, not that. Well, you know, someone always dies, right? Well, someone, you know, everyone dies of something. No. It is not a cure. Now, here is the basic problem, and this is driving all of this crap across the board. And when you have students in your class, Larissa, that say, we're going to get the guillotine out, this is why they are going to get the guillotine out. And if we don't put a stop to this as a society right now, not in another 10 years, now, because we should have done it 15 years ago and didn't, the guillotine is going to come out. Because what this, think about this, Chief. How many people, all right, you're talking about for 6 months of life, all right, almost $500,000.
Yeah, well.
Okay, all right. Now, wait a minute.
And plus, it's not really guaranteed.
Well, that's the median. Some people get more, some people get less, right? All right. Here's the problem with this. How many doses of this drug would they sell if you had to pay for it out of your own pocket?
None.
Zero, right?
Do you ever...
Now, hold on a minute. So the entire premise behind the entire medical and pharmaceutical system today is that if you get pancreatic cancer tomorrow, you can shove a 12-gauge shotgun in my mouth and make me pay the $500,000.
Yeah. Are we sure this kid isn't Hal's offspring?
Well, now there's two problems with this. Carol's number one offspring. Is that armed robbery is something that if you try it, you come into my house at 3 o'clock in the morning, try it, I'd blow your head off, and I'm perfectly legally within my rights to do it. All right. That's the first problem. Now all of a sudden we abstracted a couple of levels and everyone thinks it's okay, which is why these drugs exist. But the bigger issue is this. There may be somewhere, either in a currently existing drug or in some other compound, there may be a $2,000 answer to this problem that provides equivalently good results.
Nobody wants that.
You'll never find it.
No.
As long as I can shove the gun in your mouth.
Larissa, if you had to, we go back and forth on the medical stuff here, and the thing that, I don't know, you probably weren't listening a week ago Tuesday, but Kerry talked about his wife was having, shortness of breath or whatever, and to be safe, he yanked her to the emergency room, and, they gave her an enzyme test, and she didn't have a heart attack, and her EKG was okay, and whatever it was, they thought it was maybe an allergic, whatever. Anyway, she's there for an hour or 2 hours, and she's gone. It was like $11,000 or something, which is when you and I are always talking about it's a shock to your credit card. It isn't always going out and outspending, going out and buying a boat when you can't afford it. I read some huge statistics once that most of the causes of bankruptcy are a medical problem. There's going to be somebody else who buys the third car and the boat, but I don't know anybody like that, really. I never have. But what do you, if you had to, put some kind of a, you put your arms around the neck of this, Larissa, where would you start? Would you start with patents? Would you start with antitrust? Where would you go? I mean, because you're the economist here. I'm not even sure where I would start. I know where I'd like to end up, but I have no idea where to start. Where would you start?
It's a tricky question because I know one of the challenges is how do you justify the cost for these research? Wait, let me back up. I'm going in the wrong direction. I might start with the laws for being able to sue your doctors. A big portion of their costs are the insurance that they have to carry if they make a mistake. And I think that because it's so easy to sue somebody and be successful suing, the insurance premiums that hospitals have to carry eat into the cost considerably. I think starting there to start working backward or start really thinking about how we're charging things, and again, just the sheer amounts of insurance for everything.
Well, I would go further. That's certainly a piece of it, okay? But I don't think that you'd make a substantial difference in the issue by focusing there first. As I have maintained for a very long time, the first level of the problem is you have to get rid of the ability of companies to change what you pay based upon who you are or what affiliate you have engaged in business with that is your decision. Everyone has to pay the same price. If everyone had to pay $500,000 for this drug, they would sell none of it. And therefore, the problem would sort itself out one way or another. Now, that, of course, makes everybody extremely upset because the entire premise of a lot of these things is that I don't care what it costs. I'm not going to get the bill. Therefore, the things that we know would solve many of these problems that cost zero or very little will never be recommended, never be pressed, and no one will ever do them. And that includes discovering pharmaceutical and other breakthrough things that have very little cost. But it doesn't end there. As an example, we know, and I have, you can look at my forum, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of people who have done this. You get the carbohydrates out of your diet if your metabolic markers are going the wrong way for diabetes, type 2 diabetes, it will stop in reverse. And I can speak to this personally. Now, wait a minute, Chief. If I had, instead of doing that, gone to the doctor and followed their advice, the advice would have been starting with metformin and then additional drugs, because as the insulin resistance progresses, the metformin stops working. So then the metformin is cheap because it's off patent and it's very old. My grandfather took it, for Christ's sakes. However, as we go down that road, now you've done more and more damage to your metabolism because you didn't get rid of the crap that was causing it in the first place from what goes in your pie hole. And pretty soon you end up in a situation where it's $2,000 a month for the drug.
Okay, but Larissa said she would start kind of on the insurance side. I think what you're seeing, I don't know if you're seeing it where you are, Larissa, is the insurance. And I don't know if the insurance companies are in Dutch with these new, you know, these new medical doctors' organizations or not.
Of course they are.
Well, it seems like the individual guy pays a hell of a lot more than the. But I noticed, Audrey with all her selling houses and stuff to people knows a lot of doctors, and virtually every one of them now has had to join one of these groups.
Right. Well,
because of the insurance. So, Larissa, I'm kind of right with you. It's not only a numbers thing. It's you can't be out on your own. Which the weird part is, when you talk about the insurance being too high, I happen to it's one thing when you're not 25 anymore, you hang around with people that have medical problems, right? And some of the antics that these hospitals have done to some of my friends. I'm like, good Lord, if I was an attorney, I'd be all over these people.
Oh, Chief, here's the thing. Think about this from a different perspective. There are things that we have discovered that have been true game changers.
Yeah.
Okay. Antibiotics are one of the big ones. All right. Without antibiotics, any kind of bacterial infection that gets out of control, you're dead. That's the history of it. I mean, that's how it was before then. Nowadays, a tooth infection is a round of antibiotics, right? Back then, it very well might kill you, and it used to be one of the leading things that did kill people.
I think tooth infections are one of the only things now you still use penicillin for.
Well, what is the other one? Cephalex. It's not the floxin antibiotics. Those are quite.
But I want to ask. Listen, one other question. How do you when you talk about, and again, this administration, they just happen to be there, so I'm going to take pot shots at them. How do you stop? You're talking about the insurance thing. Now that leads to the combinations. If you're a doctor, is your insurance a hell of a lot more per person than if there were 20 doctors? And some of it might be justified, but if it's not necessarily justified, now I got an antitrust problem here someplace. So wherever you start, but I guess if I would be more concerned with combinations of like hospitals and doctors' units and things like that. But how exactly do I stop that when they're happening every day? I mean, how do you stop the river flowing when you're watching it flow?
Well, Chief, think about this. Not only is it the combinations, okay? And oh, by the way, this is the reason that one guy goes into the hospital, has a regular set of blood tests, basic blood tests that's done anytime anybody has anything significant going on, right? Basic metabolic panel that's run. He pays $37 for it. The other guy, because the hospital knows that he has a $7,000 deductible insurance plan, and he hasn't spent any of the $7,000 yet, they charge him $6,800, and he gets the entire bill. And there's nothing he can do about it. And oh, by the way, if you did that sort of a thing to somebody on a routine basis in any other line of business, your ass would be in a sling.
Sure. Larissa, tell you a quick story. One of the guy, well, he's a good friend of mine, but he's the engineer slash custodian of the building we're in down here, and he's done, you know, does a lot of side jobs for people. He has this, I should have called you for the answer because I couldn't figure it out. He ends up with a hernia, you know, a simple hernia, which, you know, it's never simple if it's you, right? But it wasn't like a double or triple. So he's got a $5,000 deductible on his insurance. So if he went to wherever they were going to send him, the surgery was going to be like $8,000 or $9,000, and he was going to pay $5,000. But he also went to a place that does hernia surgeries. It wasn't the Oklahoma Surgical Center, but someplace like that.
Yeah, I was going to say.
and they wanted like $3,000, all done.
But cash.
The cash. And, right. And he says to me, what should I do? You know what? Larissa, I should have called your ass. It was in February. I couldn't come up with an answer. I'm supposed to be this.
Right. What happens if then he has something?
Well, that's
else
what I'm saying.
Wrong.
If it was December 15th, I think it would have been an easy call. Even then, you're sticking your foot out for 2 weeks. But you know, he's got a son that plays soccer, and I'm thinking, how do you bet the whole next year that nothing else is going to happen?
Well, this is how you end up with people saying they're just going to kill everybody. Because here's the thing, Chief. Let's say that you just say, okay, I'm not going to do it. I'm not paying into this. I'm not going to play this.
Well, Larissa, what would you have
up yours?
What would you have said to do?
You know, it. I don't know. It's one of those really challenging situations.
These guys are so good. I don't know if you ever, you know, working for the university, did you ever have one of those health savings plans?
Oh, yeah, you got hosed by that one.
Yeah, we had my bro, you know, and we, a lot of people working here, we had one of those. And it was one of those things where ours was a really good one because you didn't have to use it. I mean, it didn't disappear. You actually had a special savings account where every year you ponied up $5,000 that was tax deductible, okay? And then you got a... or whatever it was, and you couldn't put it in stocks or anything. It was just in this one bank, which was even weirder. Is when the thing first came out. So we did that for 3 years, and I'm going, wow, I got like $15,000 in this thing, and you know, and now I got a $5,000 deductible on my insurance. So I got $15,000 in this thing, and I'm going, wow, I'm doing better in here than I am in my IRA, where you can only put like $2,000 a year, or so whatever it was. So all of a sudden, I had like three things wrong with me. And when I said, I don't know if I did something to an ankle playing softball, but it didn't turn out to be anything. But it was one of those where you went to your doctor and he goes, ah, you better get that one checked out, get an MRI. You know, it turns out, you know, fortunately I was fine. But I had three MRIs. The specialist and the MRI combined were like $4,800. So in 4 months, my $15,000 was gone and insurance never paid a penny. It was so special that they knew that the specialist plus MRI at Northwestern was just under $5,000, and that's what, I mean, most people, if you have a shoulder problem, okay, you're going to go in, you're going to see the doctor, I'll send you the orthopedic guy, you got to go get an MRI on your shoulder. You go in there, you get it, well, this is 10 years ago, was just under $5,000. So they never had to pay for anything, which is genius. Would you think? I'm too much of a conspiracy guy to think they know those numbers. It just didn't happen to be a smidge under $5,000 when it could have been $5,200. They had to pony up $200. They never did. It was always a little under. How scary is that? I mean, there's geniuses working for these people, but the thing of it is, it's so ongoing. It's almost like we were talking about earlier with the, I mean, I just, one of my friends, he's on Eliquis, which is the whole damn world's on Eliquis, a blood thinner, right? And try and get off it. Now it's been around for 16 years, or something like that, And it's still $6,000 a year or something. No, I don't.
Right.
I said, I don't know if you got to go, you know, go to the Amazon and pull some special fish out of there. It'll bite your ass or something to get the thing. I don't think so. I mean, as a matter of fact, I ate it once, and they said it costs $200 a year for them to pony up the stuff. I don't know whether that's right or not. But it's $5,000-$7,000 or something for the year. So my buddy, you know, helped with his taxes. Even with his Part D insurance, he out of pocket, he was like $3,000 on the stuff. Well, hell, if you're on Social Security, you're making, what are you making? $2,000 a month. So say you're 36, and it's $3,000. Hell, that's what percent of his Carl and I are always ragging about the amount of basket. Your basket, the CPI, medical care, is 6%. Well, what's that for that guy? 10, right out of the gate. I mean, that kind of stuff. I don't see how. I mean, I don't know where I would start, but you can have Obamacare, you can have Trump care, you can have whatever the hell it is. If somebody is paying somebody $10 a pill and it's costing them 50 cents to make it, you got a problem. It's a question of where you shove it around. I think the problem has to be, that's why I asked you, you think it's in patent laws, what is it? That pill, if it costs $2, all of a sudden we don't have a problem. I don't think. Because then guess what? We could pay it for it ourselves.
Yeah, but see, here's the thing, Chief. I don't know what it costs to make, okay, and neither does anybody else really, right? I mean, that's kind of the whole point of the game is...
Well, this person just got one from overseas for 3 months and it's $85.
Well, I'm saying but part of this game is hide the sausage, right? I mean, yeah. I think that we all know that. And so that's just, you know, it's just kind of how.
But I'm thinking the cost is somewhere under $85.
I think you're probably right.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, hello. But, but I don't know. And that's one of the questions, obviously, right? But yeah, I mean, here we are with all of this going on, and I'm like, where and when does this end? In a way that that doesn't lead to violence.
Larissa, tell me that kid doesn't look like Carl.
No, no, the student does not.
By the way, what does he look like? What, you ever seen Carl's picture?
Well, I also think that the student is a female.
Oh.
Well, there you go. See? It's not always as crazy, wait. Don't, guys.
You can't put that in my head on Friday, a female Carl. You can't do it. God. There goes my weekend. So what did everybody say to her? I'm absolutely enthralled by this conversation. What did everybody say to her?
They didn't disagree.
Well, see, now there you go. The thing is, Chief, it's in the back of everyone's head at this point because of the squeeze.
How do you put together the body, as they say in the side? How do you put together the part that we all seem to agree that some stuff has just kind of really been going on for like a really long time, and that crazy YouTube video? Do you think we're too far? I'll lob three things out there from my monetarist background. If Scott Bessent, if he ever turned straight, I'm not a fan of the guy, but if he said tomorrow, now some of this is Federal Reserve stuff, but if somebody said, you know what, this is crazy, we can't be doing this, we're gonna stop money, Carl and I might say you got to come back on this a little bit, but let's say we don't, we're gonna put money supply growth at like the 1.5% that we may be growing right now, and that's probably a reach. We're going to do that. We're going to throw a 10% reserve requirement on, and we're going to raise initial margin on stock purchases up to 55% from 50. Nothing crazy. Just letting people know that, you know, we're speculating on stock. I have a feeling that would cause an amazing amount of carnage. And to me, it's only, I guess my question is, are we already past the point of no return? That shouldn't be that big of a problem because it only makes sense. I have a feeling it would be a huge problem. What do you guys think? Listen to you first.
Yeah, I do. I agree. It could be easily a big problem.
Well, so if you can't come up with the cure, it's like, you know, somebody needs a shot of penicillin in their behind, but you think the hypo is going to kill them. Then what do you do?
Yeah, I really don't know.
I just hope we're not beyond that spot. I think your student thinks maybe we are, and I think maybe Carl agrees with her. But you got to try it, though, don't you? I mean, what can you do? I have a feeling that if you raise the margin requirements on stock or futures, I think you'd have a real problem with the market.
Well, I think you would, too.
So, you're the professor. You're supposed to have a solution. What did you tell your kids that are drawing guillotines on the blackboard? Did you draw them back from the abyss, or did you just let them go?
No, it's funny. I didn't. What I had commented to them was not that. I actually said, what should we do about interest rates? And one of the things that we started talking about, what happens if you raise interest rates? What happens if you lower interest rates? Who does it help? Who does it hurt? We talked about what if the government does nothing? So I think a lot of students were starting to make some connections that this is a very complex problem, because any solution that you throw out there is going to help one group and potentially hurt another group, and vice versa.
When you say the government's going to do this or that with interest rates, that's just when you saying that, for me being involved in this for so damn long, that's a very interesting statement. Because if you parcel back, see, if you weren't only 29, if you parcel back 40 years, the thought of government controlling interest rates wouldn't even have entered anybody's mind. The interest rates are the supply and demand for money and the prospective rate of inflation. But the government has been so involved in this mess, really, I think, in the wrong way, for so long that the entire society, except for, 15 old farts like me hanging around, still think the government controls the interest rates. But they don't. It's a supply. They can manipulate them, which they're getting really good at and have been for a while. But if the inflation goes to 10, Scott Bessent can go out there and buy all the bonds he wants. The long-term interest rates are going to go to 12, I think, unless they, what's the balance sheet going to look like if they don't? It'll be $50 trillion on there or what? I mean, I think most people, even in academia now, think that the government is the one who controls the interest rates, and they've been willing to go so far out on a limb. We're talking during COVID. Carl, help me with this. Didn't the balance sheet balloon by $5 trillion? I mean, that's in an 18-month period. I guess if you're willing to do that, you can manipulate interest rates. It's not exactly synonymous with setting them, though, is it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the problems, is that we've gone so far down this road, and we've done it for so long. I mean, Chief, you talked about the insurance stuff, and that's part of it. But think about this. Explain to me why we have capacity-controlled medical schools, why we have the AMA that has a monopoly on the CPT codes that every single medical center has to use in order to have any reimbursement and any billing to any insurance company of any kind. Not just CMS, but CMS too, okay? But all of them.
Well, you know what?
They have to buy. So this is a monopoly that under 15 USC is illegal, right? Yet, by the way, the AMA makes more money from that than from anything else today.
Larissa, feel free to use this.
Right? And it gets better.
Well,
Go try to become a doctor. Tell me why it costs $250,000.
Do you have any idea what you're talking about? There I was, minding my own business, in a class in 1975, and a short little guy up there named Milton Friedman, all he did was rail about the AMA had control of how many medical schools. So how many years ago is that? And you're telling the exact same story, and they still do. It's scary,
well,
isn't it?
Yeah, and this is it. And see, this is the thing, though. Is I look at this and I say, explain to me how that is legal.
Carl, this is 1975. It's the same story I'm hearing.
Not saying it isn't.
I think that Carl is saying it should have been illegal in 1975.
That's what Milton Friedman used to say.
In 2026.
Yeah, that's what Milton Friedman used to say. And he's been dead for. He has two examples, Larissa, were the AMA controlling how many doctors could enter the business.
Yeah.
Is an incredible lack of competition. The other one was cab drivers. Why the city had only he had to buy permits from people. Anybody could be a cab driver as long as you had a cab that was inspected. Those are his two examples, and one end of the spectrum and one on the other. But yeah, why is it that there's not? And that's why everybody now is becoming a. By the way, here's a question: everybody's becoming a what do you call it? The physician's PA, physician's assistant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do they control those schools too?
Chief.
I don't know. Do you?
No, but I'm pretty sure they do. Think about the underlying issue here. Why does it cost $200,000 to become a physician?
More than that.
Well, but why does it? And then, by the way, is if that's not bad enough, you do know what happens after you start with that, right?
Do you remember Katie?
Which is that you go to medical school after you have your undergrad, you go to medical school, you graduate, and then you are a literal slave for another 4 years for residency.
Without a doubt. You remember Katie? She was on the air a couple times, was two or three times. Larissa, she was a young lady, is a young lady. Incredibly bright, went to my high school, Marist. Not that I want to lob that one in there. Played volleyball, let's say very easy on the eyes, and just bright as all get out. And she spent two or three summers doing research at the University of Minnesota, and she actually gave a presentation to both Stanford and Harvard on some orphan drug, or not an orphan drug, but what was it? Carol, they found the DNA marker for some orphan disease. And she was in a group that did this.
Well, that's actually kind of cool, yeah.
And Larissa, she was, I mean, I couldn't believe it because she wasn't in any of your classes. She gave us a full rundown of who spends money for what and where the money comes for this research and how every one of them is kind of a cost center. But anyway, she now just entered her PA school in Yale. She's going to Yale. Cool. I mean, isn't that great?
Good for her.
And but the reason why she went to Yale is they're not only going to teach her to be a PA, they're going to let her work in research at the same time.
Nice.
So it's pretty, I mean, if you met her, you would love her. She's absolutely terrific. And but I mean, it was so funny. But maybe next week, Larissa, Carl was ranting about, you know, who's getting the amazing part on these patents and stuff. That's why I kind of want to go there. And she says, you know, she was Minnesota, Northwestern, and where the hell the other place was. She goes, if somebody looked, and the example I used at the time was, lob out, say, sickle cell anemia. It just came to my mind at the second. If Carl lets loose the moth out of his wallet and sends $1 million for research to Northwestern for sickle cell anemia, that money goes into this pot. There's money that goes to Northwestern Medical on just about everything, and that someone always gives them a pot. If the guy doing the research is a name and gets some money from the government, that kind of goes into the pot. Yet, and then you got somebody like her and a few doctors, or one doctor and five people like her, doing all this research, making like next to nothing, right? And all of a sudden, out pops a cure. You know, and we're not going to charge a gazillion dollars, but even if at any price, it's worth a lot, right? I mean, hell, a lot of people have sickle cell anemia. Even if you don't ream them on the price, it's going to cost something to get it fixed, right? And I said, well, who gets... Does anybody chart? I mean, this looks to me like everybody's sort of an investor. Either Carl putting the money in, or the government putting the money in, or you doing labor at $5 an hour, which should be $50 an hour. It'll end up the hospital will make some kind of a deal with Merck or somebody. It goes to patent, and Merck gets all the dough. And I'm like, what the hell's that all about? I mean, talk about ruffling my economic feathers, for God's sake. What about Carl? He's the one who ponied up the dough. He gets nothing and likes it, like Spalding in a movie. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, so when I asked you where you would start, Larissa, it's because I could think of about 50 places to start. I don't know where I would start. Sorry for the rant, but go ahead. Talk me down, Arissa, please.
Well, I unfortunately cannot. I do have to hop to work.
Okay.
It was lovely chatting with both of you.
Well, you're the best. And have a nice weekend. It looks like the weather's going to be cool. You guys weren't anywhere. You were nowhere near the tornadoes and stuff, were you, or were you?
I was south of it. We had lots of flooding, but we were south of the tornadoes.
One of my friends downstairs, her house got whacked with the something. Well, they weren't there, but the roof is gone, which leads me to believe it's not just rain.
That's a tornado.
Yeah, and but now, of course, the fight is ensuing with the... was it the wind, or was it the hole in the roof and the flooding, and they don't have flood insurance, and they're going through that circle, whatever you want to call it. And what a mess. Anyway.
Oh, welcome to what everyone in Florida deals with every time there's a storm.
Yeah. Larissa, you have a nice week, and we'll talk at you next week.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
We got S&P futures. Got a minute, Carl. What do you make of this? We got Bitcoin to the moon, silver and gold to the moon, market up. When are we selling? Ever? Are we going to sell the day after the election? What are we doing here?
Well, I don't know when people say, okay, that's enough of this, right? Because, you know, that's kind of tough to figure out. It's always tough to figure out. But there is... the root of all of this is the idea that you can shove the cost down someone else's throat.
Yep.
It's not... this whole thing with this latest pancreatic cancer drug is one of those things. It's not the only instance of it. It's everywhere. It's why NVIDIA thinks that they can throw $100 billion worth of debt guarantees on their it's off their balance sheet, but they're still their real obligations. Okay, and
we don't have much time. But I know that they're doing that, and I'm hearing it from you, and I believe you. I also know that most of their stuff.
The quarterly, which nobody ever does.
Okay, but the four companies we're talking about that they're our biggest clients. They don't have to lend those guys money to buy it. Who are they lending it to?
Oh yes, they do.
Really? So they're lending it to like Apple.
No, Chief. Where do you?
They're four biggest.
Anthropic and OpenAI are not public.
Okay, so I thought their biggest clients were like Google and those guys. They're
good God, no! It's these AI firms.
Okay, well, wait a minute. 2 years ago, wasn't it Google and Microsoft and those people?
Yes.
Well, now it's not anymore, is what you're telling me.
But now it's not so much.
Okay,
anymore.
Whoa, now that's a story.
And here's the thing.
Write that down. We got to talk about that on Tuesday.
Well, yeah, these guys go out and they raise their venture rounds, right? But they don't have $100 billion.
I'm going to say 2-3 years ago when we went through this, and the four big companies that they were their biggest clients, weren't they Google, Microsoft, Meta, and somebody else? You're saying now they're not. Okay. Well,
those are still very large customers, yes. But here's the other thing interesting. DSO, day sale outstanding, okay, is now up around 60 days. Can you explain to me why, if you're selling all these parts to very large corporations that have huge balance sheets and big fat checking accounts like Microsoft and Google, why you're not getting paid for 2 months?
Well, it's not like the interest rates are that high.
I'm just saying.
Yeah.
If I send Microsoft $20 billion worth of GPUs and I don't get paid in 30 days, they're not getting any more until they do.
Carl, when I took my year of accounting with actually the workbook, you know, debits by the window and the other by the door, the little guy who taught it, he was so good, but he wore the absolute accountant suit every day in class. You know, it's kind of like, and he was like, but that interest rates were like 8%. He goes, you never pay a day before you have to because it's 8%. I mean, nobody even considers that now because nobody gets any money in a checking account, right?
But you still, you know, if you've got money in a treasury money market, you're going to get 3.5%. But still, the point being, nobody can honestly believe that all balance sheet activity is healthy when your DSO is double standard commercial terms.
Yeah. Well, does anybody, God bless, I'm really showing my age, does anybody do the, was it 210 net 50 or 60? Does anybody even know what that is?
I used to do 2% 10 net 30 all the time.
Does anybody even know what that is now?
Probably not.
what we're talking about.
By the way, you'd be shocked how few people took that 2%, which I thought was ridiculously stupid. Yeah.
What we're talking about is if you send out a bill to somebody, I mean, most firms, as Carl knows because he ran one, most firms don't go under because of lack of profits. They go under because of lack of cash flow.
Yep.
I mean, you buy something, you make something, you got to pay those guys, and then you send it to somebody else, and they don't pay you for 60 days. That's a problem. So what people would do, they'd say 210, and that's 60. I'll pick a day. Where if I owed you, let's say it was $1 million orders or big orders even now, but if I owed somebody $1 million, if I paid them within 10 days, I could take 2% off that, right, which is $20,000, right?
Right.
And or you owe the whole million 60 days from now. But I haven't seen that in forever. But anyway, so Carl, thank you. It was good. It is interesting. We get a different view when Larissa's here, doesn't it? You sure you don't have a daughter running around somewhere, a younger one?
Well, I have a daughter running around, but not that young, and she's not in college.
Okay.
But you know what? If you've ever heard any of the podcasts that we do together, which we typically do once a week, boy, that sounds really familiar.
Yeah. Hey, I don't know if I told you, I went to this wedding last week, and I'm sitting next to my buddy John and Jerry and Dr. J. I haven't seen him forever, and I go, "Hey, John, look at that guy over there." And he looks over and he goes, "For God's sake, is that Scott Bessent?" It looked just like him, but not as many wrinkles. It looked like his younger brother. And he goes, the guy is identical. Then he goes, "Check out his wife." And I go, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Look at that thing around her neck. It's got to be $100,000. And he lobbed off some bizarre, you know, kind of stone that I didn't even know what it was. He goes, "Yeah, that's a minimum $100,000 necklace." I'm going, "Maybe it is Scott Bessent."
Maybe it is Scott Bessent. Yeah, you know, I mean, who knows, right?
Maybe put some good makeup on or something. I don't know. But I mean, boy, I never saw anybody look exactly like somebody like that ever. How scary is that? That there's two of that guy.
You know, who knows?
Yeah, who knows? SP Futures up 9, NASDAQ Futures down 37. So far, not much going on here this morning. Back on Monday, Stocks and Jacks. Ricky, nice job.
That's all, folks.